Thank you for listening to the Fail-Safe Moment. Grab a cup of coffee and let's join Rob Statham for another informative discussion helping people learn from things that go wrong.
We're with Richard Swanson. He was inducted into the Community of Human and Organizational Learning's Hall of Fame this past year. A storied, historic career, honestly. I would love for you to introduce yourself a little more, but I know you've had time serving our country in a nuclear attack submarine service. Thank you for your service. People that know me, near and dear to my heart. My father was a career Marine. And I just want to thank you for your service to our country. And you continued service to our country and industry in a highly reliable industry. So tell us a little bit about yourself, Dick, and welcome. Welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you, Rob. Well, first, we have something in common. My father was a former Marine. He was on Okinawa during World War II.
Oh, wow.
And one of the things that you may have observed is you can always tell a Marine, but not very much. And it definitely shapes people's lives.
Oh.
But I've got 53 years of experience working for a living, starting in 1972 when I was in the Navy. I was on a missile boat first, then a fast attack, and then something that was called shore duty, where I spent most of my time riding submarines and going to geographically distant shipyards and reporting back. And then I got out. I spent the next 16 years in fairly senior management roles in different departments at three different nuclear utilities, covering five different plants. And then was hitting burnout and decided that I needed to do something different. So I started consulting. And I kind of gravitated towards performance turnarounds, investigations, primarily root cause and event investigations, with a substantial number of employee concerns investigations in the areas of harassment, intimidation, retaliation, discrimination, and allegations of management wrongdoing. And that's what I've been doing. I've also, since 2006, I have taught the NRC inspectors how to evaluate event reports or root cause assessment reports that are done by the plants. And that's something that Bill Corcoran was approached back in 2005 to pull together. And so Bill Corcoran, Mike Quinn, and myself pulled together this course. We lost Bill in 2018 when he passed away from pancreatic cancer. But Mike Quinn and I have been teaching it ever since the start. We just finished up our last course week before last, and we'll be going again in March to continue. It's now a 4.5-day course, and we put the inspectors through the ringer on just what does good look like, how to tell the difference between something that looks great but isn't, and something that looks kind of messy but works very well.
Wow.
And what we have found is that nature of the class has changed year to year. When we started back in 2006, the average experience level of NRC inspectors was over 20 years. And of course, back then, we didn't have the ubiquity of cell phones everywhere and stuff like that. Back about 5 years ago, the average age level was probably mid-20s. Cell phones were always in front of them. We couldn't get them off them. And that required some different techniques in teaching. And now what we're seeing in the last classes is we are seeing people who are second career types in their usually youngest would be early 30s up into late 40s. Most of them with about 2 years with the NRC, maybe 4 years with the NRC, but a wealth of experience doing other things.
Sure.
And very attentive students. These are among the best students we have ever had. And they ask great questions because they come at it from different angles. They have seen things besides the regulatory world. And they really want to know why is this stuff relevant? And what do I do with it? And how can I be more effective? And the last couple classes we have taught have been a really switched on group of people.
My goodness, that's fantastic. You're definitely in a category. I seem to have the knack to run into people that I think you have probably forgotten more than I'll ever know. Yeah, that's I'm tickled that you're here to share with us. Let me bring you back to June of this year to co-learning conference. It was in Columbus, Ohio this year, and you were inducted into the Hall of Fame. Congratulations, well deserved. And you were able to share with the conference there. In the title of your presentation was "How's That Ride on the Merry-Go-Round Working?" And I knew from my experience with Bob Nelms and his take on the merry-go-round, a little bit I thought of what was coming, but when I sat down there and listened to you, it absolutely blew me away. In fact, you'll remember the first thing I had to get. My son was in college and he wasn't able to be there. I'm like, my son has to listen to this. It was just such a great presentation. How did you talk to me about how you ended up deciding that's what you were going to share for your Hall of Fame induction, and give us just a brief overview, a few highlights of the gist of that talk.
Okay. Basically, the whole thought process was, as I was pondering what I was going to speak about, I asked myself, okay, I've been doing this for a long time. This will be about my 14th presentation to CHO Learning, which used to be HPRCT.
Right.
And what am I going to say that I haven't said before? And I decided, okay, I've talked about investigation techniques and things like that. I said, I think I've said pretty much everything I have to say. What do I wish I would have known earlier in my career? Where is it that I have lost the most skin? Where do I carry the most scars? And what can I say that might help somebody else do a little bit better than I did in those respects? And as I thought about that, I came across the thought that we give ourselves away. We are focused on improving other people's performance, helping them do better at what they do. And these are not 9-to-5 people. These are people who live what they do. We live what we do. And it's easy to find ourselves after several years wondering what's in it for me anymore, other than giving myself away. And so I started looking at why that is. And I remembered a presentation that Bob Nelms gave a ways back about merry-go-rounds. And he said, you know, we get in this merry-go-round and it's an exciting thing. We're going in circles and we're going faster and faster. And there's distractions, loud music, flashing lights, and all this stuff. And it sure seems like the goal is to make it go faster and faster. And is that really what we ought to be doing? What a great metaphor. And so I said, okay, we are all on merry-go-rounds. What are we going to do to get back control? Because the merry-go-rounds are in control of us. We are not in control of them. And so that's where that idea came from. And when we look at how we get on these things, you know, we start out in our careers, usually in our 20s, and we're invincible. We're immortal.
Yeah.
I didn't realize I wasn't immortal until I was in my late 20s. And I think that's typically the case. I know that once my children hit that point and they realized they weren't immortal, they got a lot easier to deal with and a lot more fun too.
Sure.
But, you know, if you think back when we started that first job, we could do anything. We had unlimited time, we had unlimited resources. We were the smartest people in the world. All we had to do was apply ourselves and go from there. And so we did. And part of that was we had to adopt the way of doing business of the first workplace. And okay, that's a merry-go-round. There's a routine. We get on it. And we want to succeed. And so we ride that merry-go-round as best we can. And we look at what are we going to get from that merry-go-round. What we don't see until years later, if ever, is what that merry-go-round takes from us. And what it takes from us is it takes control of our lives. It's aggravated by the fact that we tend to compartmentalize things. We think we can separate our family life from our work life, from our church life, from our hobbies. And we don't understand that the balkanization of our lives, the compartmentalization, just aggravates the situation. And
You're reminding me one quote that I had wrote down here that I need to get it framed, honestly. Let me read. You said, you will get, you're talking about being on the merry-go-round right where you're at now. And you said, you look around and you will get exactly what you asked for, but then realize it's not what you wanted.
Yeah, well, that's a truth that I got from somebody else years ago and struggled with for quite a while. And the example that I gave in the talk was Sam Walton. And if you look at Sam Walton's life, I got my MBA back in the early 80s, and Sam Walton was held up as an icon. He was the epitome of what an entrepreneur should be. He started with one store out in Arkansas. He in 1992 he had 1,735 Walmarts, 212 Sam's Clubs, 13 super centers, and 400,000 employees. And of course, Walmart's gotten much bigger since then. It was the largest retail chain in America. From 1982 to 1988, he was the richest person in the world. He got the Presidential Medal of Freedom, which is the highest civilian honor that the country can bestow. And he said, I remember seeing a video of him in 1981 where he had told his people, you know, if you come out with a profit margin of 3.71% this year, I will dance the hula in a grass skirt on Wall Street on New Year's Day. And that was unheard of profit margin for a discount house. Well, they did, and he did. And I saw the video of him dancing the hula. But the last words he ever said, seconds before he died, was, "I blew it. I blew it." If you look at what he achieved, he beat every metric he ever set for himself. He beat every metric he ever set for his conglomerate. He had a goal back in the 80s to visit every store at least once a year. And that was back when he only had 750 stores, and he did it. But he hardly knew his youngest son. He had superficial relationships with his other children. He had no relationship with his grandchildren. His wife remained with him out of commitment to being married, not because she loved him. And he got exactly what he asked for, and it wasn't what he wanted. And what a tragedy. And part of that is the way we ask for stuff. We don't ask for stuff with our words. We don't ask for our stuff with intentions. We ask for stuff by our actions. And that merry-go-round, when it's in control of our life, we do our asking through riding that merry-go-round. And what a lousy way to spend a life. And it doesn't does not have to be that way. I also told a story of Jerry. Who this one I knew Jerry personally. I was the engineering manager on a troubled nuclear plant. We were shut down ultimately for 3 years. And talk about riding a merry-go-round there. There we were. Well, I ran into Jerry at a football game. I was a guest of a vendor. We were up in the skybox, and Jerry was the chairman of the board and CEO of one of the minority co-owners of the plant that I was supporting. Most miserable human being you would ever want to meet. He was not happy with the way the station was being run. He complained to me about it. He told me that I was doing a lousy job, that he was going to get me fired. He was going to get a bunch of my people fired. And well, the plant was in trouble for sure. He didn't tell me anything I didn't already know. But bitter, non-constructive, and here I was out there with my wife. He was with his wife, and all he was doing was complaining. Well, that's pretty much who he chose to be. I ran into him several times over the next year and a half or so while we were still in our startup process. And it was the same thing. We'd be at public meetings and he'd be complaining to me and so forth. And then we finally got started up. Didn't see him again. I left the company and went on to another utility in a different state. And I came back for a retirement party for a senior vice president that I thought very highly of. And I was talking to a whole bunch of people, and this guy came up to me, grabbed my hand and shook it and said, "Dick, it's great to see you." And it took me about 15 seconds to realize this was Jerry. This was Jerry. He had smiles on his face that reached his eyes. He had smile wrinkles instead of frown wrinkles. He was happy, energized. I said, "Jerry, I didn't recognize you. How you doing?" And he said, "I'm doing great." I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Well, I retired from the other place, and now I am counseling troubled kids at a residential school, and they're troubled because of the homes they lived in. Usually there were drugs involved. They were abused. And I get to teach these kids they have choices that they didn't know they had. I get to teach these kids they can do something with their life. And I get to teach these kids how to do it. It wasn't about the paycheck. It was things he got to do, things he wanted to do. Because he figured out he didn't want what he was doing at the other place. He wanted something else. And he went out and got it. And it was completely transformational. So it doesn't have to be that the merry-go-round controls us. It can be hard to get off, but we can get what we want. We have to figure out how to do it. And the biggest question is how to figure that out, because I don't know any place that teaches that. One of the things that I came across that I mentioned in the talk is it's very difficult, but it's if you do it answers the question. And that is, if you want to figure out what you really want from life, write your own obituary. Figure out what is it you want people to say about you at your funeral. I only know, I don't know, maybe half a dozen people that have succeeded at it. I did not succeed when I tried. It's a very tough thing to do, but it provides insights even if you don't succeed. And it can help bring a focus as to what do you want to do and what are you doing now and how are you going to make the change and
That's
how are you going to get off the merry-go-round.
one thing you had mentioned. This is a poor paraphrase, Dick, that no two people are alike, so we shouldn't try to copy or be someone else just because we like what they're doing. And this reminds me of as my career was coming up. There's those people you latch on to that you're like, gosh, I want to be just like that. That plays into the whole equation here and trying to figure out what you want and how do you get that? Because that honestly adds a little bit of confusion to the whole scenario, doesn't it?
Well, it sure does. It sure does. 'Cause, and I thought about that. When we're out in the world helping organizations and people improve performance, we ought to do it in a way that is authentic to who we are. It is a mistake to try to emulate our mentors or others whom we admire. If we're a great method actor, maybe we can bring that off. But I haven't met a lot of great method actors.
No.
And here's where I'm coming at with that is that improving performance basically requires changing dysfunctional behaviors. And if you're going to help me change my dysfunctional behavior, then I need your help, number one, to understand the specific behaviors I need to change, the reasons I need to change. I need to understand the impact that those behaviors are having on my performance or on my organization's performance. I need to have motivation to change them. I need to know the new behaviors I have to adopt. I need to know how I can self-monitor my progress and how I can identify somebody outside of myself to serve as a reference point to work on improving my performance and see how well I'm doing. And all of that is extremely personal. And my success at following your advice is going to depend upon my trust in you, among other things. And I'm far more likely to trust you if you're showing me who you really are, if you're speaking in your own voice rather than parroting somebody else's words.
Yes.
If you're using your own examples rather than examples you heard from other people. If your body language and your idiom tells me that you are speaking rather than you are channeling somebody else's message. And maybe I'm hypersensitive to that because I do investigations, but it's usually easy to tell when somebody is being authentic or somebody's playing a role. So my ability to accept your advice on my performance improvement depends upon my trust in you as a person. How can I trust what you tell me if I can't trust you? How can I trust that your advice will work if I can't trust that it actually came from you rather than from somebody else I've never met? And that's really, I think, where that comes from. It's all about selling. We are trying to sell ideas. And there are ethical ways to sell, and there are unethical ways to sell. It's not about high pressure, because in the final analysis, I control my behavior. You can't. You can influence it. And your ability to help me depends upon how effective you are at influencing. And so if you want to influence me, it starts with being yourself. And that was a real eye opener when I learned that. I have had a lot of great people I've learned from. I can't be them. I can only be me.
Right.
And so I have to take what I learned from them. I have to put it in my own head. I have to make it relevant to myself before I can help other people see the relevance in their lives.
Let me jump in here. I'm thinking about the drive to help people change behavior in their workplace. And for so long, and I still run into it, I'm sure you do, maybe slightly different industries that we're working in. I probably run into it much more than you, but you may enlighten me. The approach to change behavior through rewards and penalties. What are your thoughts on that? We'll give you a bonus if you change your behavior. We'll discipline you if you change your behavior. And I know there's a gray area in there because I'm all for discipline. I think people should know where the lines are, and if they cross them, there's consequences. You have to have that. But talk to me about in terms of changing behavior, because you just said that the only person that can change their behavior is that person, and I agree with that 1,000%.
Well, but where I have the vast majority of my experience is in high hazard industries.
Right.
And the thing about high hazard industries is the people in those industries will almost always do what they know is important to the boss, provided that it's not illegal, unethical, immoral, or out and out stupid. The only way people know what's important to the boss are three things. One is where the boss spends time and where they know the boss spends time, what they see the boss reward and what they see the boss punish. Now, reward and punish, there are some very obvious rewards and obvious punishments, and there are some very subtle ones. And what is a reward for you may be a punishment for me. Example, when I was at one of the utilities, the chief nuclear officer had an idea that we want to enhance performance of some of the the people that actually do the work, that touch the plants, like technicians. And his idea was that we would have a plaque that we would award every 6 months with a guy's name on it for conspicuous performance, and we would go down to the workshop and give it to him in front of all of his peers. And those of us that have actually worked with people at that level just looked at him and said, you might as well put a kick me sign on the guy's back, because in this environment, with this unit, what you will have just done is take a high performer and make him a pariah among his peers. That would not be a reward just because you think it is. So what's a reward is very subjective, but if we want to change behavior, it starts with the boss being very clear about what the boss wants and demonstrating that through where people see that person spend time, what that person rewards, what that person punishes, because the words mean nothing if they are not consistent with that. The other aspect of that is the way things are in an organization is a function of three things about the people at the top of the house. And that is either the people at the top of the house want things to be that way, or people at the top of the house tolerate things being that way, or people at the top of the house don't know things are that way. And when we do an investigation, which has been my bread and butter for about 3 decades now, at least,
Sure.
there is always some significant messages to deliver to the top of the house, because significant events come from the top of the house. And one of those messages is always, Dad, you got an ugly baby here. And that's no surprise, because that's why I get called in. And I always get through that conversation. The next conversation is frequently required, and I don't bet 100% on that. And that conversation starts with, Dad, there's a strong family resemblance, and you look just like your kid.
Yeah.
And that one goes a little bit rougher. But when we're looking at behaviors in a high hazard industry and major events, people don't try to screw up on purpose.
No.
They're doing what looked good to them at the time. They're doing what they thought was a right thing to do. And much of that comes from where they see the boss spend time, what they see the boss reward, and what they see the boss punish. And so if the behaviors at the deck plates aren't the right behaviors, we need to find out what it is that made those behaviors look good to the people who exhibited them, and correct them. And that usually gets us, to one extent or another, up to the top of the house and changing some policies or some directives, and figuring out how to roll that out so the top of the house owns it and delivers a message. Yeah, I was part of this too. Because if it's all about pointing the finger,
Yeah.
nothing's going to change.
Yeah, nothing's going to change. Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate you taking that sidebar to talk about behavior. I have that conversation, it seems, weekly, on a weekly basis, and it's good to hear your take. Back to the merry-go-round, the last quote that I want to mention to you. I wrote it down, we're getting frog boiled. When you said that, I wrote that. I put 3 stars next to it. I underlined it, and it just seemed to me it summed up everything. Get my listeners up to speed. What'd you mean by we're getting frog boiled, Dick?
Well, what I meant by that is that the process of riding a merry-go-round, we think we're getting something for the merry-go-round, and I guess we are, but the merry-go-round is teaching us how to be controlled by it. And it's a gradual process. It becomes harder and harder to get off. And frog boiling, if you take a frog, and if for some reason you want to boil a frog, there's 2 ways to do it. One is you get a boiling pot of water, and you toss the frog in there. And if we do that, that frog is going to leap right out and get boiling water all over everything and probably get as far away from that pot as it can. And we're not going to succeed. But if we take a pot of water at room temperature and we gently set the frog in there, the frog will sit there happily. And then we just start the fire underneath it and gradually increase the temperature. The frog will just stay there until it's boiled. And that's what merry-go-rounds do to us. That's what working in toxic environments do to us. We get so used to it that we just stay there and we don't even notice the impact that it has on us. And so that's where that analogy came from. And it's a great analogy because there is very little artificiality about it. It's what life does to us if we are not aware. And so one of the things about getting off our merry-go-round or managing our merry-go-round is we need to figure out where to get an external view, something outside of ourselves that's going to tell us if we're making progress at going where we want to go, or if we're just going around in circles and achieving nothing but expending energy.
Yeah, absolutely. What a great point. And that external view is can be a great struggle sometimes. I know you mentioned trust is involved, and I agree wholeheartedly with you. That's from our perspective, that's we want to be able to give people a process that helps them get that perspective that they can see themselves. That's we talk about looking in the mirror all the time, and an honest look in the mirror really goes a long way in helping improve behavior. But it's easier to say than to do, isn't it?
Oh, it certainly is. It certainly is. And you know, looking in the mirror is one thing. But that's like the second or third step. I think the first step is looking someplace other than the merry-go-round.
Yeah.
Because one of the things the merry-go-rounds teach us is focus on the merry-go-round, make that thing go faster. Make it more efficient, meaning let's help that merry-go-round eat our lives even better.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess as our time's running down here, looking back over your career, your marvelous career. As it relates to your time with HPRCT and now the name change Cole Learning, what do you see as some of the most promising developments over the last 25 or 30 years? And I guess the flip side to that would be not only the most promising, but things that may concern you over the last 30 years of your career.
Among the very positive things I've seen is, I guess I first spoke at HPRCT back about 1999, and it was much smaller. The focus was much more restricted than it is now. We didn't have some of the subjects that we're getting into now. But it had the same kind of energy. I will tell you as a sidebar that CHO Learning or HPRCT has been my favorite conference of all those I've gone to in the several decades that I've been working for a living. I always come away with having learned more than I gave myself. I've been to, this is my 10th conference. I have spoken at every one I've been to, usually the plenary session and occasionally some breakout sessions, sometimes some workshops. And I put a lot of effort into it. But I always come away with more than I gave, which is fantastic. I can't say that about a whole lot of conferences that I've been to.
Right.
I think that the evolving nature of some of this stuff is exciting. It means that there's more to learn each time. It doesn't get stale. The fact that we are expanding into other industries. This started out by a nuclear power plant back in 26, 27 years ago. And it now, if we look at the last conference, we had people from medical education, we had medical practitioners, we had all kinds of different disciplines and sub-disciplines there. We had AI coming in, which AI did not exist back when this started. And we had international students. We had people from Australia, and hearing some of the stories from Australia was absolutely fascinating. What an interesting place to live, and thank God I don't live there. So I think that the energy level is probably the single biggest thing. I think Charles Major and his people have done a magnificent job of making this thing a living, breathing, growing entity. It's different every year. And I think that what he has done and what his people have done has just been an incredible gift to a number of industries. On the downside, and this is a minor downside compared to the tremendous upside, is I do think that there is a, I don't know what you'd call it, a force among some people to tout their discipline as superior to alternatives. And I saw that start about, oh, probably about 6 or 7 years ago with one individual who declared root cause is dead. And this particular individual used to be a root cause practitioner. I haven't looked at his work, but I've always wondered if it was the same with him as with other people who have bad mouth root causes. Maybe he just wasn't very good at it, or maybe he couldn't convince other people of the quality of the work he did. I don't know. That's speculation. But I think that it's one thing to go to a classic car show, a competition, and take your car there and polish it up as best you can, and to go for the prize. It's another thing to go there and try to win by throwing mud on other people's cars. And so I think that's disturbing. It's I think it's getting less than it was. I think that is being slowly gotten under control. Because the fact of the matter is that the basic principles of what we're doing get back to the basic principles of how to impact human behavior in a positive way. And they're basic principles. They apply to the different disciplines we're doing. And some of these disciplines are better in some settings than others. If we look at root cause, if somebody were to tell me that one of the problems with root causes is we went into gross overkill and we did too many of them, I would fully agree. There was a time in especially in the nuclear industry where the answer to everything was a root cause assessment, and not everything's that important. And trying to overuse a technique is a sure way to push it into disfavor. The same was true of some other disciplines out there. And I think that the balance, I think we're starting to see a little bit more balance coming back to that discussion. But I would say that the parochialism would be the biggest downside I've seen. And that the good news is I think that that is being corrected. How much of that is self-correction? How much of that is subtle efforts on the part of the board, the magnificent board of CHO Learning? I don't know, but I think it's happening. And however it's happening, it's taking care of the major concern that I have had.
I know I have, I feel like a mouse in the corner, but my perspective over the last 20 years, 25 years, the first time I was introduced to root cause analysis was 2001. And with our methodology, with our approach, the first thing we had to get out in front of everybody is blame has to be banned. We can't get where we want to go if we're willing to point fingers. And I believe blame and understanding are inversely proportional. As long as you let blame live, people will never truly understand why something happened. And it would be knock down, drag out philosophical fights back from 2001, 2010, 11, 12. It would be fireworks. And I know that may not be the same. I wasn't exposed in the nuclear industry and the highly reliable organizations that you were, but in the energy field, the oil and gas industry, it was a dogfight. And I have watched that from the philosophy and the change now, the pendulum swing to where now I mention it and everybody's like, well, of course we ban blame. Now it's a different, it's one of the things you mentioned it earlier. It's easy to say that. How do you do that? Is people oftentimes need help doing that, but I think it's all influence of this pendulum that seems to like swing, and but it's more than a pendulum because I think we are getting higher. I think that's what I heard in your answer. Things are improving. Sometimes they go a little too far one way, and sometimes a little too far the other. But we seem to get back on track, and we are moving in the right direction. Would you agree with that?
I would. And you asked the question, how is it in the nuclear world? It was knock down, drag out. Blame was a big deal. One of the big eye-opening experiences I had back in 2001, I was leading a causal evaluation at a fossil plant, a very high-tech fossil plant that ran with makeup boiler water, the pH of lemon juice,
Ooh.
which is about pH of about 2.5, 2.7, somewhere in there. And it's supposed to be running at about a pH of 12, I believe, on that particular plant. So it's very acidic instead of very caustic. And if they had gone another 36 to 48 hours doing that, they would have lost the entire 3-unit plant and just walked away from it and lost all those jobs because it wouldn't have been worth repairing.
Right.
And I got called in to help out. This was a one plant out of about 10 plants throughout the US, each plant different that this company operated. And the VP of ops asked me to come in. And the second week I was there working on it, he said, "You got to tell me who I got to fire." I said, maybe we ought to have that conversation after we're done with the assessment here and we figure out what happened. Well, you got to tell me who I got to fire. Well, let's make sure that you get the right advice before you start taking action. Well, so for the next 6, 7 weeks of this investigation, I got at least 2 or 3 calls a week, same question. And I was finally able to convince them when we got down to the bottom line to let me roll it out my way. And the way we did it is I got the plant manager, all the plant manager's direct reports, the VP of ops flew in. I got the entire chemistry organization and a few other key people. So we had about a dozen people in the room and we had a seminar. And for the next 6 hours, I would feed them a little bit of information, have them do a few things hands-on.
Sure.
And they came to their own conclusions. And we got down
Wow.
the bottom line, and the VP of ops just looked at me and his face was white. And he said, "Guys, I've been harassing this man for the last several weeks, telling him I have to know who ought to be fired here, who
Yeah.
screwed up." And as I look at how this thing unfolded, everybody did exactly what we told him we wanted him to do. And if anybody ought to be fired, it's me. That's what a well-done evaluation and a well-done rollout gets you. It gets rid of the blame. But the problem with blame is, in many cases, that's what senior people think that their job is. is to figure out who to blame, rather than realize they're responsible for making their people effective, and they're responsible for giving their people what they need to succeed, which includes knowledge, it includes pushback, sometimes it includes discipline. But people don't screw up on purpose, generally speaking.
No.
And if people are trying to do the right thing, then maybe they need help in figuring out what the right thing is, or figuring out when to ask what the right thing is. And I will reinforce what you said with that story. That was one of my most satisfying moments in the last several decades.
We could, we could share stories very similar to some of my most satisfying moments, very similar. Thank you so much for your time, Dick, and sharing. If listeners out there want to get a hold of you or connect with you, what would be the best way? Social media or email or?
Best way would be email. And my email address is RNS, as in Romeo November Sierra, at PMI, as in Papa Mike India, and then a hyphen, INC, as in India November Charlie, .com. That's
okay.
RNS at PMI hyphen INC .com.
And
And
I'll
please
put
put
it up
it.
on the screen.
Okay, thank you. And please put up, or please put something like Failsafe Podcast in the subject, because I get about 300 emails a day and about four or five are worth doing something with.
Oh my goodness. Oh, I don't, I can feel your pain, but I thought I had it bad. But again, it reminds me of, I think, what I started with. You're in that category. You've probably forgot more than I'll know, but I'm not going to be discouraged. I'm going to keep trying to learn and grow. So thank you for your time, Dick. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Rob. It was a privilege talking to you.
Yeah, likewise.
Thank you for listening to the Failsafe Moment. We'd love to hear from you. Share your comments and questions below or contact us through our website, www.failsafe-network.com. Once again, that's www.failsafe-network.com. Until next time, have a great day.